Who let the dogs out?
Who let the dogs out?
Who let the dogs out?
It is time for Pet File Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Traditional small animal medicine and surgery, chiropractic, laser therapy, acupuncture, and Chinese herbal medicine, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com. With us today, Dr. Carolyn Cannon, owner and chief vet of said Millerton Veterinary Practice. Hello, Dr. Cannon.
Good morning. Beautiful day.
Such a nice way to start things. I mean, if it weren't a beautiful day, we'd say that anyway, right?
That's true. Every day is.
Because some of us were raised to just acknowledge the good, and that would be you.
And to choose happy. A friend gave me a choose happy T-shirt.
Okay.
But it's bright orange, so I don't know whether I'll be wearing it.
Or you can go outside and wear it and not be hunted. How about that?
Okay.
It's very safe. It's very good for this time of year, although I don't think anyone would mistake you for a turkey. All right.
I hope not.
Oh. All right, Sarah Bell in Belfast, Maine. My 6-year-old Turkish Angora cat, Griffin, is the love of my life. I took him to the vet several times to try to discover why he was rapidly losing weight, and they couldn't find anything. Yesterday, a doctor friend of mine tested his fur and told me Griffin has a lipase fat enzyme deficiency. That makes sense to me because his skin is flaky, his poop is horribly stinky, and he's always trying to get at the butter dish. In the short term, I'm desperate to get some weight on him. Can you tell me if there's any supplement I can give him to help with fat absorption? Are there particular types of fat that might be easier to digest? Any advice? Much appreciated.
So this is a great question. This is a question, I think, referring to a particular disease process that happens in dogs and cats, and it's when they have an insufficiency of the pancreatic enzymes. So the pancreas is this little organ that is just past the stomach. It's adjacent to the duodenum, or the first part of the intestine. And it is responsible for, has two different major responsibilities. And one of them is to produce insulin. So that's its endocrine responsibility. That is meaning, endocrine meaning hormonal. And it's exocrine responsibility is to produce the enzymes that break down the food that come out of the stomach. And I think that, you know, from what's being described, there's a good possibility that Griffin might have EPI, or exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, it's called. So he might not be producing the enzymes that come from the pancreas. Now, the lipase is one of the enzymes, and that breaks down fats, but it would be super unlikely, and I don't think has ever been shown that any cat would just have an insufficiency of lipase. So they wouldn't make enough lipase or amylase or protease. Those are the major three that come from the pancreas. So of course you would see weight loss. I've never heard of testing hair for that. I wonder if this is a veterinarian or a people doctor. But there is a wonderful blood test that helps to diagnose this disease, and it's run by the gastrointestinal lab at Texas A&M. It's the only place in the country that runs it, and it has to be done on an empty stomach. So we want a 12-hour fast and do that blood draw, and it goes to the lab. It tests for the pancreatic enzyme, so it's called a TLI, or trypsin-like immunoreactivity. So basically it's telling you whether your cat has pancreatitis, whether it has a deficiency in the B vitamins, and whether it has a deficiency in these enzymes, so super important. Cats and dogs usually will have sometimes even an oily-looking stool because the fats don't break down. Very odoriferous stool. And
that would be horribly stinky, right?
So so it smells different than, much worse than usual.
Right.
And they lose weight. So they do lose a lot of weight. And they're very hungry. So trying to get at the butter dish wouldn't be unusual. So it's possible that this is what's going on with Griffin and that he can't break down these foods, and so they're washing right through, going out in the diarrhea, and very difficult to get any nutrition from. So what I would recommend is you know,
waste no
working
time
with a veterinarian and getting the test, and then it's fairly easy to treat, easy compared to some other diseases, in that you give the pancreatic enzyme. So there's a whole pig pancreas powder that you can get and give at a particular dose. You mix it with the food, basically. You don't have to let it sit there for a while. You just mix it in with the food. Of course, cats can be fussy about mixing things with the food, but the great thing is that these cats usually are super hungry and will eat anything. So at least early on, they will go ahead and take that enzyme in the food. Now, what causes this? You know, it's possible. My understanding is that some people are born with the problem or born with the predisposition to acquiring the problem. In cats, we think that it can come from chronic pancreatitis. And so it's great that this test also tests for pancreatitis. Now, we don't know what causes chronic pancreatitis in cats. They clearly don't drink a lot of alcohol, but they can have inflammatory bowel disease, which can also affect the pancreas and lead to chronic pancreatitis, which then can lead to exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, which is, I think, that may be what Griffin has, and diabetes. So you definitely want to check for diabetes as well. Sounds like Griffin's already been checked with general blood work, but maybe not this special GI test. So what I'm getting at here is that sometimes it's more complicated than just giving that enzyme for treatment. Sometimes they need to have other medications to help with inflammatory bowel disease and occasionally diabetes.
So basically, if you were to sequence that, the first thing would be to get the fasting blood draw and get that off to Texas A&M.
Yes.
And then while you are waiting, is there anything he should be eating, if you know, in the interim that would make life a little bit easier? Or
well,
just
potentially, you know, for a week or so, a lower fat diet. Even though she's losing weight, a lower fat diet might be a little bit easier to digest and cause less diarrhea and so less weight loss in the end. But it's not a good answer long term, because she's either high fiber and or low-fat diets tend to deplete the vitamins and minerals over time. So,
right.
You know, it's a good bet that if this has been going on for a while with Griffin, that he might already be somewhat depleted.
So just leave well enough alone, get the test, and take it from
there. Yeah, that's the way to go, because it's pretty simple. You're supplementing with what the cat is missing. And it usually works really well in just a few days.
All right. Sarah in North Adams. I have a spayed female corgi who's about 6. She seems fine, but lately the way she urinates has changed, and I don't know if I should be concerned. She squats to urinate at normal times, and a normal amount comes out, but then she starts walking away while she's still urinating. Or maybe it's that she's dribbling as she walks away. Either way, it seems weird to me. Is this an older dog thing, a corgi thing, a weird new habit, or a sign of bladder problems?
Most likely it is a sign of a bladder problem. Urinary incontinence, but I can't be sure. Some dogs will have other issues going on with the bladder, and that causes them to be difficult to control the urination. So she should be able to close up that bladder sphincter and stop urinating and get up and walk along without dribbling. So there may be some primary urinary incontinence. We know that it usually responds to estrogen, although we don't use estrogen that frequently anymore because it can be toxic to the bone marrow. But, you know, we're pretty sure that it has to do with taking away the hormones, the sex hormones, and sometimes when the adrenal glands are exhausted as well, can cause a problem with dribbling of urine. So the first thing to do is to get her checked by your vet and bring along a urine sample. First morning urine sample is the best thing, because we want to make sure that there's no sign of infection or inflammation. It would be unlikely to have a cancer that's affecting the that area of the bladder, but it's not unheard of. So those cells sometimes can be seen in the urine. So the first thing to do is to get that urine sample, make an appointment first, then get the urine sample on the morning that you go, if it's possible. Otherwise, your veterinarian should be able to collect one when you're there.
All right. And
and then there are medications to help, all kinds of different things. You can see, if you're averse to medication, you can go and see a Chinese medical practitioner. There are herbal formulas that will help depending on different types of formulas, depending on what the root cause is of the incontinence based on the Chinese medical diagnosis.
All right. Sounds like there's plenty. There are plenty of different modalities, which is always nice.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And this is from Luis in Castleton on Hudson. I heard about a German Shepherd in the news who got COVID. I have a German Shepherd, so I want to know if they're especially susceptible to it. And no matter what the answer to that question is, I want to know what we should be watching for as far as COVID symptoms go to be sure our dog doesn't have it.
I think there was a German Shepherd back in the summer that was positive for COVID, for coronavirus, the novel coronavirus. And, this was the first dog, I think, that's actually maybe the only dog that's actually gotten it. Maybe there have been some others. I know when it was discovered in the pug, it turned out that it was the dog did not have coronavirus, actually. It was just in the nasal cavity. So German Shepherds are not necessarily more susceptible, as far as I know. I don't think there's a particular breed that's more susceptible to it. These animals, even the tigers, the lions, the cats, they're getting it from their people. So the people are transmitting it to the pets. This German Shepherd lived with someone who was positive for COVID. And there's no evidence that the pets can then give it back to people, to other people. So at this point, worldwide, with the number of cases that we've had, we definitely would have seen a pattern. So it's important, though, to stay away, if you are COVID positive, to try and stay away from your pets.
Because your pet can get it, right?
Your pet can potentially get it. I don't think that there are a lot of pets that do get it, but potentially they could get it. And my understanding is certainly in the big cats, they had fever and lethargy and a cough.
Can they retransmit it? And I'm asking because I don't know if you know about the Danish mink cull that was just, so.
Yeah.
And then that was then changed.
Transmit it to other cats, you mean, or to people?
Yes. I have no idea. Both. Neither.
Any. So I don't know about the lateral transmission to other cats. There's no evidence that we can see at this point that it can be transmitted to people from cats or dogs. So, the mink issue, I can tell you that ferrets, for instance, can transmit influenza to people.
Right.
So I wonder if it has something to do with, I think that we as humans must be very, very...
responsive.
Very much like a weasel. That's
I guess.
The word I'm looking for. We must be weasel-like in our immune systems or something.
And all I know is I read it and I thought, oh my goodness, all of them. And then shortly thereafter it came out, was like, well, we're not entirely sure that this is it, but it could be. And
yeah.
I'm thinking, you basically...
Well, that's what they raise them for anyway. They raise them and kill them.
Yeah, but it's whether or not you can use it. I'm not forgetting that practice for a second.
Yeah.
I'm just
yeah.
saying it would be helpful to know that this is like,
exactly.
Oh, this is the problem before, completely eradicating. But people do this. I'm not talking about mink calls, but people do this all the time. They decide something, and then they think that it can be just hived out of, or separated from the whole, which
yeah.
just is a baffling procedure in my view. But
especially, right, a direct cause and effect.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to determine, and you have to stop and think about are the things they have in common, and
Right, but the key thing to that before you is to stop and think, and there are so many who just go straight into it. And so I'm sure you encounter this in your practice because, you know, someone can come in for one thing and you can deal with the one thing, but it could be something else entirely. You know, you could have two different things going on easily, and you have to have a sufficiently open mind to, not you as a vet, but one needs to have a sufficiently open mind, and I think that maybe unless you have animals, you don't know, like, oh, yeah, it's like, oh, his foot hurts. Well, it must be that he stepped on something. Oh, well, there's nothing that it looks like he stepped. You've got to be curious. That's, I think, is where I'm going to leave it. Mm-hmm. Maddie in Kingston, is there a chemical-free way to repel fleas on cats? My kitty, who's about 11 months old, has a sensitive constitution and doesn't do well with anything chemically. But I'm subletting a house where she can go outside and hang out on the porch, so I'm worried that if I don't do something to prevent fleas, I might get an infestation in this house.
So, this is a little bit of a difficult, more of a difficult and involved question. So, you know, if you're, I guess I would just put it out there to anyone who is renting or subletting to make darn sure that the house is, that the pets who have lived in the house the last couple of times, you know, that they haven't had a flea problem. Because if your cat's really just going on the porch and there's been no pets allowed in that apartment, or you're sure that, you know, it's been treated, maybe fumigated, treated prior to going in is probably the best way to prevent fleas, which is the best way to live. You know, if you can go into an environment and bring your cat who has never had fleas and doesn't have any fleas on them into an environment that doesn't have any eggs or live fleas, then even if they're going out on the porch, oh, I'm assuming it's a screened-in porch, though. So maybe I'm wrong. If your cat is going outside, they have the potential to get fleas from other animals. If your cat's going out on a screened-in porch and in a house in an apartment that doesn't have fleas, you know, you may not need to do anything.
All right,
That being said, if you don't want to have fleas and they have a significant risk for contracting fleas, then you have to be very careful about the natural, quote-unquote, things that are out there to put on cats, because most of them are made from essential oils, and cats do not do well with essential oils. They, especially those that have phenols, heavy numbers of phenols in them, they are the compounds that give off the smell, and they can be really harmful. Cats they lack the enzyme in the liver that breaks down phenols, and so they can go into liver failure. And they can also have problems breathing. You know, their sensitive noses are many, many, many times more sensitive than ours, and they really don't like the smell of most essential oils. And so they're going to lick it off and try to bathe it off, which isn't good for them. You can have vomiting, et cetera. My understanding is that there are some companies that make a cedar wood essential oil from a non-toxic cedar, and they treat it to remove all of the phenols. I haven't really seen this work. I haven't had people come in and say, oh, I use this special cedar wood oil because my cat doesn't mind it and doesn't try to lick it all off. You know, it just doesn't happen. Cats don't like anything topically put on.
So what's the safest, I don't mean chemical free, what's you know, if you don't put a topical on, is there a kitty chewable?
As far as chemical?
No, as far as chemical.
Oh, I see. There isn't a chewable. There isn't a chewable. There is only the topicals that you can put on now that will last. There's a Bravecto topical that will last for 60 days. That's probably the most common thing that people use. Advantage Multi or Advantage for cats tends to work pretty well. That's an over-the-counter. There's Revolution for cats, which really doesn't have any tick effectiveness, but works great for fleas.
But all of it's a topical. All right, so I know I have to go and bend in my spare time.
But if you put, you know, if you put an appropriately diluted cedarwood oil that's treated and non-toxic to cats, up between the shoulder blades, you're still going to get fleas on the rest of the body. So that's the problem there. There's, you know, people use diatomaceous earth. That's not really safe. It's not safe for you to breathe it, and it's not safe for your cat to breathe it. If you cover your cat with coconut oil, there's some effectiveness against fleas, so your cat's going to spend the entire day either getting things off that are stuck to her or ingesting too much oil and throwing up.
Yep. No, it sounds like
a dilemma.
It does sound terrible. I just, so that's, therefore, since I'm a yes or no guy, I just thought, all right, so there's not really an efficient chemical-free way. So what's the least worst of the, of the flea treatments, if that's something?
Yeah, and they all have the possibility of especially just a local reaction.
Right.
But Bravecto and Catago are the ones that I would recommend as far as the lowest numbers of reactions that I've seen.
Okay. And apropos, this is a question that I could have, this is a question that I've had, but it's Will in Poughkeepsie. There's this new product called Simparica Trio. It's a monthly chewable thing to keep parasites off dogs. According to the ad, it's supposed to be safe for puppies. My question is, the dog in the ad is an Australian Shepherd. The warning is that you should use caution with dogs that have a history of seizures. But as a breed, Aussies are prone to seizures. So I'm confused if the warning means to use caution if your specific dog has had seizures or with breeds that are prone to seizures.
The warning is specific to your dog in particular. So if your dog has a seizure disorder or a history of having a seizure, then it is contraindicated. But that doesn't mean that, and all of the drugs in this class, Simparica has Serolonner. Bravecto has another one. I've forgotten the name. Credelio has another one. They're the Olaners. All of the drugs in this class are contraindicated in animals that have seizures. And that means that those dogs might be more susceptible to having seizures when it is placed on them. Whereas...
What if they haven't had it yet? I mean,
if they haven't had it yet, if they're going to have a seizure disorder and you put it on, I guess it's possible that they might have a seizure and then you would never use it again.
Okay, but bottom line, unlike this goes back 100 years, but unlike Amitraz, for example, which was on flea collars that sort of caused old-fashioned that could cause seizures, this doesn't. It's just if you have a seizure dog, you don't. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, no, it shouldn't. Apparently, you know, early on, when it was used on dogs that had seizures, then it would exacerbate the seizures. And then there's probably, I'm sure there are dogs out there too that had never had a seizure and all of a sudden had a seizure. So that's what the warning is. But there are, you know, millions of other dogs who are taking, and it doesn't mean that in golden retrievers who are susceptible to seizures, maybe a particular line of golden retrievers and the mothers had seizures and the sisters had seizures, etc., I wouldn't use it.
Right. But it's not the Aussie per se.
No.
Okay. It's not the breed that has seizures as, you know, one of the things that they could have.
There
okay.
are several breeds that are prone to seizures, not just Australian Shepherds.
Yeah. No, it was just what is striking, the reason I said that it could be one of my questions as well, was I do know that Aussies are. And that I remember this, and I remember seeing just the visual of, hey, that's an Aussie. And then
on the package?
No, on the commercial.
On
the advert.
Commercial.
Yeah,
oh, you see, I don't watch commercials.
I understand.
Commercial, so.
Right. But on the commercial, it's an Aussie. And then, of course, comes the warning that, you know, you shouldn't use on dogs who are prone to seizures. So
right.
I just, you know, that is just a visual it's like a disconjunct is what I'm trying to say. It's like, huh? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, we see many, many, many Australian Shepherds that
don't
have seizures.
Right.
So,
of course.
Yeah. So I think that it is, again, safe. And it's the same thing where the the collie breeds, including the Aussie, can have a genetic defect where they can't metabolize certain drugs. And, you know, those dogs, so sometimes the people won't use any of those. Early on, people wouldn't use any of those drugs at all. But we've come to find out that you can actually test these dogs for their deficiency, their enzyme deficiency, and you can use the drugs on all the rest of them it's the multi-drug-resistant gene, it's called. And so, you know, over time, we find these things out is what I'm getting at. And I wouldn't use it on a dog who has either a history of having a seizure or a presumptive seizure, or who's a direct family member has had seizures.
I think that's very realistic.
Canine family member.
Right. Okay, not human. All right, thank you very much, Dr. Cannon. It has, as ever, been a pleasure. This has been Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com.
Who let